Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever and whenever you may be, and welcome to episode 151 of the Fade to Black podcast. I'm Hannah Flint.
I'm Clarice Lockery.
And I'm Amon Woman.
This week, Amon sits down with Ghostbusters Frozen Empire director Gil Keenan, while we review the Nostalgia Pack sequel alongside another 80s remake, Roadhouse, and heartfelt animation Robot Dreams. Amon also sat down with star Benedict Wong to dive into the mysteries of Netflix's Three Body Problem. Plus, in our hot take, we talk about boycotting screen stories because of the unscrupulous use of AI. Da, da, da. Before we get in, let's have a quick catch up with the group. Guys, my internet's working. I'm so happy.
Yay! Welcome back, both to the internet and Hannah.
And yet. So last week I had internet issues. This year someone stole my credit card details and like hacked my like Facebook or some sort of Hotmail account. Jeez. So I had to like do all that. Jeez. So I'm like, what the fuck's going to happen next week?
Just one adventure to another.
Yeah. Touch wood. I hope you guys haven't had as much of a dramatic week as I have.
My jacket arrived that I ordered. It's annoying because it's not a visual podcast, but I bought a cowboy jacket and with all the little frills. So when I go,
this ain't Texas. Woo!
I was going to say, I'm very excited for the Beyonce country album, but I didn't buy it because of that. That just is a coincidence. I would like to make official, but I'm very excited for the album.
Well, I'm actually really intrigued about the discourse around it, and I find it really interesting about... It's really annoying because I think Azealia Banks is a trash person. She said super racist things, but she did this whole post about like how Beyonce has not even engaged with Black country artists, like also the kind of history of country music, and seems to be sort of like... I don't know if she said this or that thing, but it seemed like she was like... somewhat doing like an Aunt Jemima of country music sort of thing when it came to like the blonde hair, the kind of the American flag. You know, I've seen people I quite respect talk about like who wants that imagery or patriotism right now when like America's
like leaning in,
giving bombs to Israel and stuff. So I thought that was really interesting. I mean, I feel like I'll still listen to the music because she's a bop, but I do appreciate that we are getting a point in this time where people are having this real like real critical kind of engagement with artists who sure do the intersection of their identity but also billionaires.
And how are they like do they think that they can actually create art within a vacuum? It's the same thing with Taylor Swift,
like you know,
she's creating art in a complete and total vacuum, and it's very noticeable.
Yes.
At the same time, it's, you know,
as a reason not to, you're not allowed to touch them because of feminism. Exactly. It's like feminism isn't, that's not what feminism that But I will say, just on like the billionaires and stuff, black women billionaires, I read season two of Loot is coming up on Apple, and I don't know if you've seen it with Maya Rudolph, but I adore it, and I've like watched season two and it's great. So if you want to get someone engaged with like Jeff Bezos' divorce, the wife tried to get rid of all her money sort of comedy situation, that's a quite good one to watch.
Cool. One thing that I want to ask you, if you've watched, Hannah, X-Men 97. I was talking about it last week, but I couldn't talk about it with you because you weren't here. But now you're here. X-Men 97, what say
you? You know what? I can't give you a full thing because I started watching last night when I was doing some transcribing and I realized I can't do both. One thing I really did, I thought was really interesting though, is how they really were like, let's use a darker crayon on Storm.
Yeah.
They were like, let's not leave this open to interpretation. I think she's even darker than the comic book versions of it, which, you know, no issues. She's a black woman from Africa, you know? Mm-hmm. So I thought it was interesting that like the opening sequence had the first X-Men that you see are Bishop and Storm and obviously Cyclops coming in. I will say I did watch that first action sequence. I do think it's, you know, a massive fan of 97, but I think the fight sequences are really well shot and there's a real fluidity to the animation that's a real step up and really reflection of where we are at today. So I do like the nostalgic look, but I also like the fact that there's a kind of real, dynamism to how these characters are playing out.
Fully agree. I love Pike. I really like with Cyclops now, his optic blasts, they're not just for damage, they also, he also uses it for movement.
Yes.
And that's really, really cool. And Cyclops, he still hasn't been given his justice on a live action screen, but this show has always done well by him in terms of he is the leader and we're going to show you why he's that dude. And they do.
Yeah.
So that's great. And, you know, I don't know how far you've gotten, but everything, I think the two stand out so far are Magneto and Storm. And where they're taking those characters in particular feels really fresh. And the merging of that freshness with the animation of the storytelling with the nostalgia of it all. Because that theme song still whips. Like, I turn the volume all the way up all the time. The skip intro button will never be used, ever.
Also, I love that they put, like, the first time you see Gambit, he's wearing a crop top.
Yeah.
It's like, you were like, we're making this thirsty as fuck. I'm intrigued about the kind of the firing of the showrunner, though.
Yeah.
Before it's even been launched. So yeah, I guess
that
we'll
was
get
not a good look.
We'll learn a little bit more about that. But that was kind of crazy to me. But yeah, I'm excited. Also, I love that, like, on Instagram Reels, it pulled up the original voice artist. Is it Allison Seeley who does Storm? And it showed her doing the voice. I can't remember her full name. But I was like, yeah, my girl! Sounds just as great. So that was
Mistress of the Elements!
Yeah. Well, speaking of climate change and the powers of it, let's get into our first film. Here's the trailer for Ghostbusters Frozen Empire.
For the first time in New York history, a room full of people froze to death in July.
It's an unimaginable evil with the power to kill by fear itself.
Like, literally scared to death?
Now it's headed straight for us.
Something trying to get out?
Many things.
You're as cold as ice. You're willing to sacrifice. You're as cold as ice. Who did, like, I'm trying to remember the artist of that. Because there was one which had that as a sample and then the rapper, right? I can't remember who it was.
Foreigner? I think it's Foreigner. It is Foreigner.
That sounds right. Hmm.
I remember liking that song a lot when it came out, whatever it was. Anyway, Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. In this film, the Spengler family returns to where it all started, the iconic New York City firehouse, to team up with the original Ghostbusters, who've developed a top-secret research lab to take busting ghosts to the next level. But when the discovery of an ancient artifact unleashes an evil force, Ghostbusters new and old must join forces to protect their home and save the world from a second Ice Age. It's directed by Gil Keenan and written by Keenan and Jason Reitman, and it stars Paul Rudd, Carrie Coon, Finn Wolfhard, McKenna Grace, Kumail Nanjiani, Patton Oswalt, Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, Ernie Hudson, and Annie Potts. And yes, I spoke to the co-writer and director, Gil Keenan. We recorded this on Friday. I spoke to him on Thursday this week. And it was a really, really lovely chat. He's obviously got a lot of love for the franchise. It was really impressive to me. This film, from when it started shooting to the turnaround, it's basically been 1 year exactly, which is very, very quick for a movie of this size. So the fact that he was able to even do that was pretty crazy. But yeah, we talked about Ernie Hudson and Dan Aykroyd and putting them in scenes together, two of the OGs who I think get the biggest slice of the action in this film. And we talked about some of the ghosts. We talked about him moving into Ghostbusters animation because an animated series is coming out very soon and he's very involved in that. So yeah, it was a really, really fun chat and I hope you enjoy it. Me and Gil Keenan.
Welcome to the Paid By Podcast. Gil Keenan, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great. Really happy to be here.
Good stuff. Good stuff. We're here to talk about Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. I watched the film. When the film ended, the guy who was sat next to me, a colleague of mine, he leans over to me and goes, is the Ray Parker Jr. song canon? So that is my first question to you now. Is the Ray Parker Jr. song canon within the Ghostbusters universe?
It has to be now, right? I mean, look, there is a rich tradition of Ghostbusters. I mean, let's not forget, Ghostbusters began as a nascent business in the first film, right? They were trying to create not just a way to sort of harness their interest in the supernatural. They were creating a brand. I mean, these guys started out with a hand-painted sign on top of that firehouse. Halfway through the film, there's a logo. They're putting patches on their flight suits. Mm-hmm. The second Ghostbusters famously had an update with a 2 on the poster and in the film. Right. There is a sort of understanding that Ghostbusters has, I wouldn't say a tongue-in-cheek relationship with its own image, but at least an awareness that there is a brand within the film. They were on covers of magazines, real magazines, in the first film. You have to imagine that a song as popular as Ghostbusters would have made it part of this world. I believe that we can safely say that the Ray Parker Jr. song is canon.
I was just saying before I walked in to the people outside, this song's in my head still already.
I got to tell you, I've been working on this movie for a year now. Yeah. I've heard that song, as you can imagine, maybe like 1,232 times.
Yeah.
It never gets old. It's got the most uncanny properties to just stay fresh every time you hear it. It's magic, that thing. I just got to meet him. I got to meet him last week in New York at the premiere.
Amazing. And how was that?
I mean, it was so cool. I heard a story, actually, while I was making it. One of the executive producers of the first film came by to visit me on the mixing stage.
Awesome.
And he said, yeah, I remember sitting in the stage at exactly this moment in the mix in 1984, and the movie was still coming together. It was all sort of just being pulled together from the various elements, and they didn't have the theme song yet. And it was getting pretty close to the release of the film. Ray Parker Jr. showed up on the mixing stage with a cassette tape, a demo that he had just sort of finished recording, played it for Ivan and company, and everyone's jaws kind of dropped, and they put that exact taped recording into the film. So he didn't even have a chance to go back and remix it or anything. The thing that he brought in was what we've heard all these years.
That is incredible. That's amazing. That's amazing. I want to meet Ray Parker Jr. I'm very jealous of you right now. You mentioned the mixing stage. I wanted to ask about that because with the Ghostbusters film, there's a lot to juggle. There's new fans coming in. There's the fans of the classic films, such as yourself. And I guess there's a studio element to that as well. When you're in the post-production process, you're trying to find the right balance of all these things. Like, how was that on this film in particular?
Well, there's obviously a lot riding on every movie. Making movies is an act of tricking the universe into allowing something to exist that it doesn't naturally want to have happen.
Yeah.
One of the things that both helped and hurt this film, or didn't hurt it, but I should say one of the obstacles to finishing it was also one of the things that allowed it to stay pure, was how little time I had to make this movie.
I heard it's like a year time. People say it's a year since you were on set.
We started rolling this movie 1 year ago yesterday.
That's incredible.
It's a very short amount of time. The good news there is that the movie that you see in the cinemas is so close to the sort of pure version of what we set out to write when Jason Reitman and I sat down to write this movie like 2 years ago. Obviously the difficulty there, the obstacle, is everyone just had to work at breakneck speed. And it's not dissimilar from how they had to do it in 1984, actually. There was also a release date, June, that they had to race to finish. And sometimes you just end up finding that kind of spark of inspiration, that extra reservoir of energy, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. It helps that a lot of people involved are Ghostbusters fans.
Yeah, that's always helpful. What is the scene in this movie that the 7-year-old version of Gil Keenan, who's just watched Ghostbusters for the first time, would really be excited for, do you think?
Well, I don't want to spoil too much, but I think that the version that I can feel myself sort of watching through my fingers and getting really excited by is the sequence when the audience finally and fully meets Garaka, our villain.
Yeah.
It's a sequence that I take great pride in because I feel a lot of the same energy that I felt in movies that I loved growing up. I feel that sort of spark on the screen, and I love watching that scene with young people in an audience because you can just feel the suspense. And it's not something that young audiences get to experience in movie theaters very often. Mm-hmm. It's really satisfying for me to see that.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite scenes when he emerges. To that point, Ghostbusters films, they're a little bit scary, especially for younger audiences. Is there someone you go to as a litmus test for, is this scary enough? Do I need to up it? Do I need to lower it when you're in the making of this film? Or are you just trusting your gut?
You just asked, in the previous question, you named that person. It's 7-year-old me.
Yeah.
I mean, I am able to think back very clearly. I mean, I think a lot of us who love movies and live in movies in any capacity are able to sort of mark important or sort of gateway movie experiences in our development as moments where you can actually sort of crystallize the experience and come back to live in it if you need to, or for a sort of happy memory. Mm-hmm. For myself, that 7-year-old who sat in a movie theater is absolutely a barometer for how to measure the tone, the swing from comedy to horror, which is a part of a Ghostbusters story, is you know, I'm really lucky that that kid is still available to me to have conversations with.
That's awesome. One of my favorite elements of this new movie was Possessor. That ghost is fantastic. Where did that idea come from, and how much fun did you have playing around with that and really pushing that? Not to spoil, I'm not going to spoil what happens and what the ghost goes into, because I want audiences to experience that, but I had a lot of fun with that.
Thank you so much. I'm really proud of Possessor. It's a new idea in a Ghostbusters movie. In fact, I think it's just a new idea, period. And it came out of a very early conversation that I had with Jason Reitman, my partner and co-writer on this film. It was talking about the emotional power of an object that is left behind when somebody passes. Right. And we do talk about this idea in ways big and small in this film, and it actually has a bearing both on the Garakan mythology and on Melody, one of our ghost characters' story, again, without getting into territory that might spoil the film for new audiences. And we were looking for a way to have some fun with this core idea of a spirit inhabiting an inanimate object.
Right.
It's actually almost the primal definition of animation, right? It's bringing life into something. And so it was so cool, so fun to find a way to give voice, shape, movement to this very simple idea of a spirit that can inhabit, almost like a hermit crab. That was actually one of the analogies that we used in defining this character, looking for a home, figuring it out. And just because you asked, it actually excites me that thematically this Possessor ghost is doing, in a much more playful or diabolical way, something that Phoebe and the Spangler family are doing. They're searching for a home too, in the firehouse in New York City, in the institution of Ghostbusters. So, not to draw too many parallels, but it is there.
Yeah, oh, I love that. Dan Aykroyd and Ernie Hudson, fantastic in this movie.
Thank you.
I really loved seeing them back on screen, and those scenes when they're paired together, especially. Yeah. Can you talk about that and being a fan of those original films, putting those two characters together? I can only imagine what your face must be doing offset as the camera was on. But
I can't tell you what joy it brings me every time I see this film. Specifically seeing, there's one scene that I think you're referencing between Dan and Ernie, when they're having quite a heated discussion about the path forward and whether it even is, you know, sensible or healthy. Yeah. For them to continue this sort of direct investment in the pursuit of this supernatural mystery that's at the center of the story. There is something that happens when these guys are together. And specifically in that scene, I felt like they were playing somewhere deeper than just the scene as it played out. They were talking to 40 years of shared history, both on and off the screen. And I have to tell you, it was a very small crew that shot that. We were just about five of us in a stairwell here in London, not too far away, actually, in the old underground office building. And there was something special that came to life in that moment. Mm-hmm. But in every experience I had with both of them on this film, there was a real willingness for them to go there. They've known these characters for so long now. They've known each other for so long, and mm-hmm. they were game and trusting to allow me to take them to places that sometimes were a bit more emotional. And I'm really proud of that.
Yeah, yeah, love those scenes so much. Speaking of giving people their moments, Annie Potts gets a big one herself. I read that wasn't initially scripted.
That's
so
correct.
Where did that idea come from? And to trust your instinct, like we're gonna shoot it on the day.
Well, to be fair, I had an early conversation with Annie Potts when I called her to talk about this film, and I think that Annie is brilliant at advocating for Janine, for her character. And she asked me, and it wasn't something that was pointed. It was something that was earnest, and I felt like it landed on a very receptive audience. She asked me if there was a way for Janine to be involved in some of the action. And that was enough for me because I got so excited by that question that it sort of led me on a journey to find a way to do that, not in a superficial way, but actually make her a part of the ghostbusting team that, of course, she's always been a part of. Yeah. So the way it really came about was that Alexis Forte, who's one of my two costume designers, asked me what Annie was going to be wearing when everyone's getting suited up for the final battle. Mm-hmm. And the answer almost surprised me as it came out of my mouth. I said, she's got to have a flight suit. Mm-hmm. And I called Annie up. I told her what I was thinking of, and she was so delighted. And you can see it on screen.
Yeah.
The joy. It feels like a moment 40 years in the making.
Yeah, I love that. I love that you gave her that. I love her reaction to that. That's fantastic. Obviously, when we're talking Ghostbusters, everything you're doing is following in the footsteps of Ivan Reitman to a degree. If you could watch this film sat next to him and ask him about one scene in particular, what scene would that be and why?
Well, I do wonder if it would be the moment we discussed about Ernie and Dan in the stairwell, because I think that there is something playing in that scene that speaks to more than just the story that we're experiencing. Mm-hmm. It speaks to a lifelong relationship with characters in a world that means something to the people who have been touched by it. And I've seen, I was lucky enough to sit next to Ivan and Jason at the world premiere of Ghostbusters Afterlife, the first time we surprised a huge audience at New York Comic Con with that film. Mm-hmm. And I watched the emotion, the pride he had in watching the characters that he first brought to the screen in 1984 thriving with new audiences. I would have loved to have had the opportunity to watch this film with him, with an audience of fans. But I have to say, Jason and I feel him in every screening of this movie. Mm-hmm. He's a Ghostbuster forever.
Absolutely. Final question for you. Your Ghostbusters, you're still very much involved in all of the things, including the animated series that is coming up very soon. What excites you about Ghostbusters, bringing Ghostbusters back to that medium?
Well, I think that animation gives you a freedom. Animation is an infinite canvas. It means that we can bring a lot more supernatural elements, and that was one of the things that I loved about Real Ghostbusters as a kid growing up, that every week the mythology would push out into new and exciting frontiers. That, for me, is particularly thrilling, that there can be a big, visual, no-holds-barred supernatural experience that goes in every direction.
I'm excited to see it. Gil Keenan, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed our chat. Appreciate it.
Thank you, man.
Where to start with this film? So in Afterlife, which is the film previous to this, they did try, especially in the final act, a blending of the new characters with the OGs. Here, that is even more evident, even more evidently what they're trying to do. Do you think that mix works, Clarice?
Well, I'll be upfront. I thought I really did not like Afterlife at all. because, I mean, I guess we can get into it. The whole, like, reverence for Ghostbusters, I think, is ridiculous. And I am, like, one of the biggest fans of the original. Very much wanted to be a Ghostbuster when I was a child.
I have one of those traps.
Really?
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, yeah. The Ghostbusters. We had the Ghostbusters Playmobil, like, firehouse.
Wow.
Ghostbusters is a real big thing in my family.
My way of expressing my fandom is I tried to switch to parapsychology at university. Dr. Richard Wiseman, who's basically like the real life Ray Stantz. He's a legend. I love him.
Amazing.
So, yeah, that's a tricky question.
Sorry to segue, but I'm so intrigued by what you did at university, because every time I hear you talk about what you studied and stuff, it's like archaeology, classic history, like it's all these bits of buzz. It's like, God, you just had the best time. Like, I kind of feel like you had the university that if I went back now, that's the type of things I would have loved to study rather than just doing boring, like, you know, the typical English, like American studies, that sort of thing.
Yeah. It was really fun, and then I was drunk for most of it. So it was
a pretty good time. Yeah, I'm definitely drunk for most of it.
Pretty good time.
I was not sober. Stone cold sober.
it's a little tricky for me to answer that question, because I find all of the nostalgia in these movies, I find it very cynical. I find it quite annoying. But at the same time, I think what I liked about this one is that the movie remembered that this is Dan Aykroyd's baby. Like, Ghostbusters is his idea, because his special interest, I don't know if people know, he's autistic. His special interest is the paranormal. And he was like, I want to make a comedy about that. And that's what the original Ghostbusters is. And so I think on a, like, purely selfish level, seeing him be in so much of the movie and clearly just feeling a lot of joy, and just, I like that they gave him so many lines that are just explaining the paranormal. I enjoyed that. Should he have been there? Maybe not, but I think for example the Paul Feig Ghostbusters, I think, is better because they actually took the effort to develop and introduce new characters that worked as Ghostbusters. I think the new family in this, like, Paul Rudd is fantastic. Paul Rudd's great. Should he be in a Ghostbusters movie? I don't really know, because he is a very, like, charismatic former Ant-Man sort of Hollywood guy. And to me, Ghostbusters is, you get the nerdiest comedians you can find, and the characters they play, the whole point of Ghostbusters is, like, here are these academics with these incredibly niche interests that everybody in the city hates and finds really annoying, and they're fighting bureaucracy for the entire movie. And then they save the day and everybody reluctantly likes them again until the next movie, where they're hated again by bureaucracy. And I feel like if you cast Paul Rudd, who's just like,
he's really not an outcast. Exactly. That's the problem. I think that also just speaks to, like, the way Paul Rudd has been positioned. Like, he is a hot, conventionally attractive man who's funny.
He was Paris in Romeo and Juliet. You cannot tell me that man is a nerd. Sorry.
He's that, like, he can be, like, even in, like, Clueless, he was, like, the hot sort of nerd, but still, like, hot because it's Clueless, so he has to be. So you're totally right about that, about, and even, like, is it Carrie Coon? So I always get mixed up.
Carrie Coon, yeah.
I always get him mixed up with the Anatole. But I think you're right. Like, these are kind of somewhat acerbic characters who, I just think this kind of family situation, and I guess this is the issue, I guess, go back to your original thing, like mixing the old and the past. It is so beholden to nostalgia that it fails to make this story make any sort of sense in modern times. You know, there are so many sort of plot holes in it. Like, okay, and interesting, you know, James Acaster, he'd be a great Ghostbuster. He's a good ghost. He should have been the main. Yes. You know what I mean? They should have had that. Like, that's great. Makes sense. There were just like ways that people put them in New York. Like, you know, the podcast friend and then the girl Lucky. It's like these stupid, really flimsy reasons why they would be in New York and working. Like, how do, I don't know. These kind of setups didn't make sense. There's also this, it's 2024 or 2023, right? Why is it when Winston has invested, he's a philanthropist, millionaire, multimillionaire, why are they still using the same shitty hearse? Why have they not updated all their equipment to reflect better day? If he's got this investment, why is it that about 30 minutes into the film or 40 minutes into the film, suddenly he reveals that there's actually a secret Ghostbusters facility that they could have been using the entire time that they've started being Ghostbusters? You know, it makes no sense that this would play out that way. And yeah, I guess, I mean, we started spoken about it afterwards, Clarice, and I know and something you're saying about the idea that, you know, New York bureaucracy, they don't give a shit about ghosts. They see it as like a rat problem. So of course, they invest. But it's like, these are ghosts. I guess, like, why is it that people are still pretending that they don't exist? And why hasn't there been infrastructure kind of put in place to invest or help them? Or like the FBI aren't getting involved? Like, it happened in Oklahoma and now, so it makes no sense to me, this whole thing that suddenly the fate of New York City and the world to fend off this very orientalist big bad, it's going to rely on like this like blended family of dysfunctional people led by a neurodivergent 15-year-old who ends up getting a very queer-baity relationship with, you know, a 16-year-old ghost. It's just doing the least.
Yeah.
While also, like, doing, I guess, the most in trying to, like, remind you of, like, the Ghostbusters and how much... And it kind of, in doing so, just reminds you of how much better the Ghostbuster original films were.
There's a lot to unpack there. I will say that I thought Dan Aykroyd was the best thing about this movie. He was really, really great for all the reasons you say, Clarice. I'm a little bit more in agreement with you on the poorer than the found family of it all and how the nostalgia really takes away from giving those characters, the newer characters, more fully rounded arcs. And I think that's the main issue with this film to me. There's too many characters to serve. And on the one hand, I admire Gil Keenan for wanting to give everyone their moment. Clearly, like literally everyone is going to get a little bit here and a little bit there. But when you do that, then you're going to, it means that characters who should be more well developed, the two or three that you should really be focusing on, they remain underdeveloped. So that was an issue for me. The other big issue for me in this film, the in-movie intelligence or lack thereof. Ghostbusters are meant to be halfway smart. There's a lot of not very smart decisions.
They're supposed to be annoyingly smart. Like, they're like acerbically smart. They're like, yeah. they're just like dickheads.
There's one thing that happens
it's
in
Big
the
Bang
final...
Theory level of dismissiveness of smartness.
There's one thing that happens in the final act that just had me shaking my head because they find out, or rather one character finds out that everyone's proton packs is not, they're not going to work on the big bad. And she tells people this, and they only end up modifying one of the weapons. And then as they're shooting the proton packs at the big bad who turns up again, she says the line again, this is not going to work, while everyone shoots their proton. I'm like, hold on, you've been told that this is not going to work. you've only decided to modify, like, just like stuff like that was just really irritating me. So yeah, there was that as well. But even with that, I'm going to say that Dan Aykroyd is great. I think one of the most inspired things about this film is Possessor. I think that ghost and what it's able to do is really clever and smart, and I like how they run with that. Was there anything else that worked for you? Was there anything that worked for you at all? Because I know that you're a little bit more negative on this film than I am.
I do think this was overall better than the last one. I think that it was funny in parts. Some of the stuff made me laugh. I think there was a couple of scenes that was scary. There's a scene where they're in the lab and like the there's a sort of a Jurassic Park the security's gone down moment. And I will say, I was like, okay, that's well shot. That feels like a Ghostbusters moment to me. There were little moments in this I was like, okay, we are like on our way to a Ghostbusters movie. We're not there, but you have moved in the direction of Ghostbusters. But I'm not particularly like make another one to get there. I'm like, we're good.
Yeah.
Also, I found it really annoying. Like, I like Kumail Nanjiani, but what I was trying to say earlier about, right, so it's a setup. There's a bit where he says, oh, it's Meso-Arabic hieroglyphs on this MacGuffin, you know, kind of the ball. Then later it says, he says, like, Southern Asia, right? And I guess the concept of the Middle East was basically invented by the British and colonial forces. Technically, so Meso-Arabic is kind of like Iraq, right? Mesopotamia is Iraq, right? So that's like Southwest Asia, right? It's not the Middle East, it's Southwest Asia, right? That's what they call it. And then they go to the Semitics department in the library, and Semitic languages are Aramaic, Arabic, Hebrew, you know, that sort of thing. So that they cast like Kumail Nanjiani, who is a Pakistani actor, right? It's just once again where it's like there's clearly like this Orientalist thing is like suddenly he represents like this, his family. I guess the whole point is like the legacy of his family from there. So it clearly has no sort of like real specific identity. They're just doing the classic thing of, you know, it's basically like when they put use the Taj Mahal as the basis for the palace in Aladdin. That sort of, let's just throw all these different ideas together rather than having a clear culturally specific sort of like big bet. And that for me is once, and just another point of like laziness when it comes to anytime there's like a sort of Eastern, like non-Western, like non-Occidental sort of villain. And that was just a bit, it's not like the worst thing, but it was also like, oh, come on, like guys, like
it was
make it specific to like him.
Cause they made the, yeah, they say the language is, yeah, it was the Meso-Arabic. But then it can't, but I think they say it's like Sanskrit later on. So I was like, which fucking is it?
Yeah, but that's what I mean. It's like, it's, it, but yeah, that's the point. It just doesn't care. It's just throwing words around. It says South Asia. So it's like saying, oh, Africa. So it's like that big of a region, like, and South Asia. Well, where? Southeast Asia, Southwest Asia, you know, Central South Asia. Cause South Asia, I guess, is like, you know, India, Sri Lanka, like Pakistan, Sri Lanka, like maybe like Afghanistan, that sort of area. And then Southwest is like more. But if you're going to say Meso, and then I don't know. Anyway,
yeah,
I just think it's that sort of laziness.
That line was there. Yeah, there was like, which I guess like the original Ghostbusters, like it is all just nonsense. But I feel like in 2024, you could do it with a bit more, cultural clarity.
Yeah.
They don't have to have a real, they don't have to have a real god. Yeah. I mean, that god's obviously made up. I did Google it.
Of course you did.
Google it.
I will say the one sequence that I thought was good was the opening one where it goes back in time into like early New York. And then it just made me think like, oh, it'd be really cool to do a Ghostbusters like prequel. If you're going to do it, like do it in the 1900s or like 19th century. Yeah. That'd be really cool. I'd love that.
Ghostbuster.
Yeah. I like the sequence that followed after that as well, when they're in Ecto 1, chasing after that ghost. That was fun. In general, even though, again, she's not given the best storyline, I thought McKenna Grace is a really talented young actress, and she did do a pretty good job. Again, not the best storyline. Final thing I'll say on this, I thought we were really done with Beams in the Sky for final acts. Apparently we're not. Please, let's leave that in the past. We've had enough of that.
Let's just leave Ghostbusters in the past. Like, if there's a third Ghostbusters film, I really want to put it out there that we don't cover it, because I think we need to stop enabling these people.
Yes. Us not doing a Ghostbusters review is what's going to stop this franchise.
I guess the point of us is like, what other films could we talk about this week that maybe we've been like, it might be a bit more discussion than doing this one? Just because it's like the big film of the week. I get it. I get we have to do it, but it's also like, oh God.
Yeah. Which is frustrating to me, because I think Ghostbusters as an idea could work as like a series. If they did, like, I will defend the Paul Feig one. I don't think it's amazing, it's incredible, but that to me is what a modern Ghostbusters film
is. Yes, I agree.
You get the biggest comedy stars of the day. You get, like, again, we said James A. Acaster. It's really annoyed me that he was in this movie and they didn't let him be funny. He's just like the exposition dump machine. Just like, why the fuck did you cast him then? That is not his energy. He should have been playing the weird guy who's been weird all the time. You get the biggest comedy stars of the moment. You come up with a ghost premise. Can be anything. Just has to be fun and silly. And then that's your fucking Ghostbusters movie. You don't have to do any of this. You don't have to have Bill Murray in it. Let that man just retire, for fuck's sake.
And even his position in this film is so weird. It's so weird. It's really like,
very clearly did not want to be there. So
he was,
or maybe very, or maybe there was something to do with like certain issues he's had on other sets that cancelled, that they were like, we need to reduce him.
Which is why I think we can just move past, you know, putting Bill Murray in Ghostbusters movies. Let's evolve past that.
Yeah.
That's what's frustrating. Is that I think you could make Ghostbusters movies, but not like this.
There's nothing in these last two Ghostbusters movies that's as funny as My Cat. And we will leave it at that. It's time for our screen, stream, or skip recommendations.
Sorry.
On Ghostbusters, Frozen Empire. I'm going to go to Giggling Carice first.
It probably is good. I think I will say stream just to see Dan Aykroyd. I'm not gonna lie, seeing Dan Aykroyd that happy made me happy, and I'm not gonna lie about it, so I'm gonna say stream, but probably skip, let's be honest.
Hannah Flint.
Skip.
I think I'm gonna join you on this. I think I'm going to have to join you on the skips on this one. There is some stuff to like, as I've noted, but on the whole, it just doesn't quite gel. And yeah, who knows if we get more of these films, we shall see. From the Firehouse to the Roadhouse, it's time to talk Roadhouse.
Before we start, do you have insurance?
What?
Your coverage good? Like, you have dental?
Oh, haha.
Is there a hospital nearby? Is it, like, too far?
About, like, 25 minutes, I'd say.
I just slapped you. Are you all right?
What?
So you like to fight. You ever win?
No one ever wins a fight.
Hit the road, Jake. Don't you come back no more, no more, no more, no more. Hit the road, Jake. Don't you come back no more. No.
What you say?
In this adrenaline-fueled reimagining of the 80s cult classic, ex-UFC fighter Dalton takes a job as a bouncer at a Florida Keys roadhouse, also called the Roadhouse, only to discover that this paradise is not all it seems. Directed by Doug Liman from a screenplay by Anthony Bagarozzi and Charles Mondry, it stars Jakey Gyllenhaal, Daniela Melchior, Billy Magnuson, Jessica Williams, Joaquin De Almeida, Austin Post, and Conor McGregor. Okay, have you seen the original Roadhouse?
No.
Yes.
I feel like I saw it so long ago and I can't quite remember it. But I also remember it not being great. And I guess, like, as in, like, not the greatest Patrick Swayze. And I always think, when I was thinking about the Roadhouse, the remake, and what we should remake, I think there's a really good point that we should remake films that weren't very good, maybe not very good, and try and give them, like, a new lease of life. I guess, Clarice, I'll come to you then. What's your relationship to the original, and do you think that this is a good way to show the new lease of life in an adaptation?
So I had to finish Roadhouse this week because I have seen Roadhouse, but I didn't finish it because it was playing when I lost my virginity.
I had
to go back and just catch up with the bits that I didn't watch. But I kind of think Roadhouse is great. I don't know if I'm, you know.
80s version?
The 80s yeah. version.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know.
Well, I assume you didn't lose your virginity this week, so.
No. I'm just going to say my review of the new one is that nobody's losing their virginity to the new Roadhouse.
No way. Absolutely not.
Yeah, but I quite like the original Roadhouse because it's very 80s, and there's a scene where Patrick Swayze is doing shirtless Tai Chi. And he's like slicked with oil.
Oh, God.
And then it cuts to two separate old men who are like looking at him, being like, yeah, America. It's an incredible scene. And like Roger Ebert's review, I love for Roadhouse because he's like, yeah, I mean, this is kind of somewhere in between, you know, good, bad, and just bad. But if you are an ironic person, you will probably enjoy Roadhouse. And I feel like it's one of those movies. And I am an ironic person and I love bad movies. So I like the original Roadhouse.
Mm. And so the new one, it's a new one, you don't think it?
No, I didn't like it at all. I didn't have any fun.
Mm.
It wasn't fun.
Yeah, yeah, I have to agree with you, but Amon, I guess the way you went, ooh, brother. Sorry, you really gave me that.
What gave me away? I was trying to keep it on the DL. My gosh.
What's this, brother? Sorry, I'm obsessed with that like meme format at the moment.
Where does that come from?
It's come from this like Australian like imam who's
Margo, is that you?
Who's talking about, I guess it's people who are like do things at haram. And it's just him going like, the video is really funny of him. He's like, I guess he's like a YouTuber or something. He's like,
hey, because I've heard the audio on different videos.
I did have some fun with this, mainly because of Jake Gyllenhaal. You know, I'm a sucker for like, you know, guy rolls into town, handles, falls in a very sort of, you know, confident way. It reminded me a little bit of what they've done both on the big screen and on the small screen lately with Jack Reacher in terms of like, look, I know I'm that dude. You don't know that I'm that dude, but I'm going to warn you. I'm going to warn you and I'm going to warn you again. Just, you can walk away. You can walk away. And those guys just don't get it. And then stuff happens. I like that. The way in which Gyllenhaal handles himself in those scenes, it's very gleeful. It's very confident. I think the action is shot pretty well. Doug Liman directs this and he's moving the camera everywhere. And it sort of gives it a lot of dynamism and energy. So yeah, I did have fun with this in parts.
I guess for me, as the number one Jake Gyllenhaal fan on this podcast, you know,
so much so
I'm
that
more
only
than
you
like,
can call him Jake Gyllenhaal.
You can try it. I mean, feel free, go ahead. I'm not going to gatekeep Jake Gyllenhaal.
That's very anyway. Kind of you.
You know, as much as I'd like to Jake Gyllenhaal with it, the Jake. Anyway, so I guess the point was to say that I'm quite, you know, I'm always game for it for one of his films, and mm-hmm. I'm always going in with like glasses half full energy. But maybe it was because I watched this after Ghostbusters. I wonder if I was just really tired that day or something. But there's something about this which as exactly what you said, Clarice, it's just not fun. It takes itself so seriously. And, you know, and even the sort of characterization of Dalton in this, where he's got this like history of violence, I guess. And I'm really not a fan of UFC fighting. So that type of stuff, like, you know, don't get me wrong. I can get behind a boxing film or a fighting film, but there's something about the kind of UFC element that I just found really like off-putting. And I guess this kind of the flashbacks and forth that felt really jarring at times when they came in. And there were far too many of them. It's like, get to the point. And I suppose it's this idea of, you know, you said like, I guess it's trying to be a bit more like a Western.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
the outlaw comes in and goes out and that sort of thing. And the anti-hero, he's not a hero, he's like an anti-hero thing. Mm-hmm. But even, you know, at the road, I just didn't really understand, like, this is just like a really basic thin storyline. And if you're going to do really a basic thin storyline, at least make it really kind of funny. Otherwise, there's bits in it where it kind of reminded, like, you know, they have this like, I wonder what you think about even like the Roadhouse setup where, you know, I think about From Dusk Till Dawn and like how great that kind of club is. And like, even like the kind of vampire band behind that, you know, there was a kind of element where they had these people behind a cage, which could have been fun, but it just reminded me of like better films, which kind of had a bit more playful energy with that. I guess then storyline really then kind of get into that sort of, typical, oh, there's a big property developer and they want to shut down the Roadhouse, but actually he's like a spoilt little son, and I don't know.
Yeah, because you mentioned the barbed wire on the stage. That's from the original, because what really annoyed me, because this is like, oh, this is so the 2024 version you would make of this movie, and it's so predictable, that I love in the original, he Dalton is hired to this Roadhouse because it's like the true like hive of scum and villainy vibes, and every single night there is an all-out bar fight.
Yeah.
Everyone gets involved. It pissed me off. In the original, the women are fighting. There's a close shot where the bartender like grabs a bottle and smashes it on a guy's head, and she's like, oh yeah. In this version, I guess because they don't, I don't know, some weird like, we're trying to be feminist, but it's somehow sexist the way that we're doing it. They're like, oh, the women can't fight. The women are too pure. The women are too good. Fuck that. Hate that. Boring. And the Roadhouse that he's hired for in this movie, really quite nice, actually. It's like this beautiful beachside bar.
Yeah.
Where it's actually fine. It's a really normal bar, and there's a normal amount of fighting for Florida. There's like one little fight every night. It's fine. But the fact they have to hire him because of this property developer and his like motorcycle gang, and it's just so much less interesting. And also the Dalton character in the original is like a poet warrior. He's like, he's really into philosophy, and he like, he's like, I really don't want to hit anybody. Like,
yeah.
And that's a great character. I found this one. And this is the thing. I'm not saying, oh, it's not,
you know, like a Jedi. Know. They're peacekeepers, exactly. But they'll like fuck you up.
And I'm not saying this to be like, oh, it's not exactly like the original. But I'm saying, like, look how interesting the original was, even though it's quite a bad movie. In this version, I found the Dalton character so uninteresting because, yeah, he's just a UFC fighter that has a dark secret, and you've cast Jake Gyllenhaal, and he's not playing a full-out psychopath, which I think would have been more fun. He's very, like, I don't know, there's a whole thing where he's always like, oh, is there a hospital nearby?
Can I
take the cab to the hospital? But it's not played in a, like, oh, my God, he's a psychopath kind of way. It's played like he's, like, Deadpool or something. It's, like, very MCU kind of quippy dialogue. And I'm like,
oh, that's such a good comparison.
Make a decision with the character. Like, make him be something. He was sort of nothing. And then I hated that he was making friends with a little girl for no reason.
Yeah.
I'm sick of friendships with little girls in movies to prove that the character is not all that bad a guy.
They're played by Pedro Pascal.
Yeah. But also, it's even like, sorry to give away the like one of the last lines on this, but it's like, you know, you might not be the hero, but you're not the villain either. And it's like, fuck off. I guess I want to get into that with the villain part of it. Amon, like... Oh. Talk to me about, I guess, Billy, but also Conor McGregor.
Yeah. Well, Billy Magnussen is especially having fun as this, like, this smug fool who, you know, he's got daddy issues, to put it mildly. Conor McGregor, I'm just going to say up front, I'm not a fan of him generally. Just some of the stuff that he's said in the...
Oh my God, his Wikipedia page. I don't really know anything about UFC fighting. I knew he was kind of shady, though. I looked up his Wikipedia page. How the fuck are they letting him in movies? Genuinely.
It's quite disturbing. Yeah. It was controversial casting for all the reasons you say, and you can sort of go and look at it. It's a very one-note performance. There are moments a fun here and there for it, but it's very, very one note, and he's a much better fighter than he is an actor. So we'll leave it at that, with the business. And it was fine. Like, it was really Jake Gyllenhaal that I latched onto here, and I did have fun with it. I think he is having fun. And it says there's one great line in the final act where there's a showdown between Conor McGregor's fighter and Jake Gyllenhaal's, Dalton. And Conor McGregor's like then a speedboat. And Conor McGregor's like, oh, looky here. I own the little octagon. Jake Gyllenhaal's like, what? Who taught you shapes? That's funny. That's fun to me. And there's a lot in the film that plays in that register, or at least enough of it for me to enjoy it. So, yeah.
I didn't get that,
I disagree
though.
About... Oh, yeah. Well, go on. You
octagon,
go first.
Just quickly, I didn't get that joke.
It's the name of the ring.
Yeah, that's what do they call the ring. It's not literally saying it's an octagon shape. That's not the UFC ring.
Yeah.
I wanted to.
Yeah,
like,
that I didn't laugh.
I wanted to put my hand up and be like, actually, look,
like,
I'm not a good guy.
The worst person in the world made a good point, you know? You know what's actually, I will just say, like, I don't like, I'm the same with you, I don't like Conor McGregor, but he is the only one in this film having fun. Literally the only one who is getting it up to a level where it's like he feels like he's in the movie that it should have been, in this kind of like very like over the top kind of like, just he's also just makes him such a gross character, and I don't know how much acting is involved in that or just Conor McGregor's gross personality coming through, but he is the only one to me in this film who seems like he's actually like not taking himself seriously, kind of just going over egging it, and yeah. Just very pedestrian, such a pedestrian film to me. Is anything else you want to, and you know, some of the fight sequences, I will say some of the fight sequences are interesting. They had a little play around from the perspective, the first person point of view of the fighting. They do a lot of like camera whips, whipping around of that. So it looks like you're the person like looking between fighters. So you get that kind of audience feel of what if you were watching a fight in front of you. Anything else that you wanted to add before we give our verdict?
With the fighting, I do like that it feels impactful. You see the damage being built up over time. There's sometimes you watch these fight scenes and, you know, lots of punches are traded and the impact is not really seen or felt. This is not that. And I appreciated that.
Oh, actually, I do have a comment to make. There was no sex scene in this. I just find that really weird because it's Roadhouse. You're remaking Roadhouse and you've not put a sex scene, and also nobody's throat gets ripped out. What are we doing here?
Yeah.
Why are we here?
So let's do our stream or skip. This is on Prime Video. Clarice.
Skip.
Aman.
Stream. I would have loved to see this in cinemas. I think we'll have played well in the crowd.
Yeah, I'm going to say skip. Sorry, Jake. Not for me this time.
Watch the original Roadhouse.
Yeah, I'm actually going to watch that this weekend, I think. I haven't seen it so long, and I feel like everything you've said is like, I need to reacquaint myself with the king, Patrick Swayze, RIP, rest in peace. Okay, from the Roadhouse to the Doghouse, this is Robot Dreams.
Changing every day in every possible way.
All my dreams.
My dreams. It's never quite as it seems.
I'm really impressed that you're able to do that without doing an Irish accent, because I'm always like, never quite as it seems. Like, I always have to do like Dolores.
I'm like that with zombie.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think anyone
My mother. That. Yeah. Zombie. God, we need a zombie movie so we can do that.
Yeah. This is Robot Dreams. The story follows Dog. It's all caps. Dog, who lives alone in Manhattan, who decides to build himself a robot companion. One summer night, Dog, with great sadness, is forced to abandon Robot at the beach. Will they ever meet again? This is written and directed by Pablo Becerra, based on the graphic novel by Sarah Varon. This movie really made me cry a lot. But I think let's talk about the animation first, because what is unique about Robot Dreams is that it is a film entirely without dialogue. And I would say not only that, but the actual animation, the character animation is very simple. It's very detailed backgrounds, but then the dog and the robot, it's two eyeballs and a little line mouth. So they're not working with a lot, and yet I think are doing incredible things. I mean, Amon, what did you think of that, as the technical aspect of it?
Superb for all the reasons you say. It's 2D animated. It's very, very simple, but they are showcasing a range of emotions with what they have. It is the textbook definition of doing a lot with a little. The animators are absolutely fantastic. We should mention the animation team is headed by director Benoit Thurumont. And yeah, it's just incredible work around the level of detail that they managed to wring out of such simple craft is incredible.
And the story is interesting. I've had multiple people be like, oh, do you think kids will like this? And I'm sort of interested in what it would be like for a parent and a child to go see this, because I think the child would have a great time because it's a dog and a robot and it's so colorful and there's all these little jokes. And we'll get into the dream aspect of it in a second. But then I think the adult, I think their movie will end and the child will go, Mummy, why are you crying? Are you okay?
Yeah. Well, it's making me cry now thinking about it.
So, Hannah, do you want to talk a little bit about this story of friendship and, like, this really profound desire to find connection?
Yeah, and I think, you know, what makes a great children's film is that they go, and I guess the hallmarks and the foundation of most children's films, fairy tales and all this, is about learning lessons about life. And, you know, I see this, it's in a way it really captures it, like the transitory nature of relationships. Mm-hmm. And how I think one of the beautiful things, and I guess this is why I get really upset and worked up, is just the idea that you can like have a friend or person for a moment in your life that was really there for you, and then, you know, circumstances might meet, they like go away, but then you're always going to have that moment. And I think it's about like finding things where it's like, Scott, I'm really upset. I'm really crying. But I guess, I think for children, you know, especially someone who, you know, and I'm sure Clarice is you as well. It's like you might change schools, you know, you might move to a different country, you might move to a different part of the world, you know, or move in, even if it's, so there are friendships that you're going to have that you're going to lose and you have to kind of move on and you have to experience life in a different circumstances and, you know, how it can be really difficult. And certainly in this case, the idea that a dog is like, you know, he sees around him, he's like alone in one of the I think that's what's so beautiful. I think it's so interesting, you know, that it's New York as well, because one of the most overpopulated places, and yet you can feel so alone. I think it really captures that. And so I think the idea of like putting yourself out there and trying to make connections and stuff, and then things might change and things don't last forever and things change and people move on or whatever, I think that's really beautiful. And certainly with like adults, obviously that's a thing that we're coming from a place of, we might have gone through this so many times. And I think I quite like, in a way, there's almost like a romantic element to this.
Oh, this is a love story, 100%.
Yeah. It's like a real, like, I mean, yeah, it can be, you can see it platonically, but mm-hmm. I also see this as this real, like, love story about finding that connection, and the love will always exist. And I think just for an adult side of it, like, the way relationships with robot and dog and, you know, yeah, the kind of we'll remember, we'll wait. But then, you know, you kind of have to, life forces you to cope and not close yourself off to one person and open up. And yeah, mm-hmm. I just, so there's, you know, not to give away the ending, but that was just, I kind of don't want to say it because I think it would just like give it away a lot. I'll tell you guys. So yeah, it's like, you know, it's very similar to one of the most popular films we've seen recently that I'd be really interested for listeners, once they see it, to maybe tweet us and see what you think the film is.
Yeah. I mean, Amanda, I want to hear your opinion as well. I think the part of it that really got me as well is about the difficulty of making friendships as an adult, which is why I think it, mm-hmm. it potentially going to hit the adults harder than the kids. Because if you kind of think about it, it whittles down in this movie to the dog just wants to like find somebody that doesn't laugh at them, which that hit me really hard. Because there's a scene in a bowling alley mm-hmm. where he, you know, he kind of fucks up and the whole bowling alley starts laughing. And mm-hmm. it's like, oh, I really felt that in my bones. And I think, yeah, it's this idea that, you know, I think at our age, to like make a new friend, you have to make yourself really vulnerable. And that's really scary because you have to open yourself up to somebody who might, and this is quite a dark movie, you know, it's not just someone who might laugh at you, someone who might also manipulate you and hurt you. There's shit that happens to the robot that is upsetting. I think that's the part of it that really took me by surprise, is to have an animated film be so honest about, yeah, the difficulty of making friends. Amon, was this like something else that, because I think we're all connecting to slightly different parts of the movie.
No, I connected to that part of the movie as well. You know, humans are wired for emotional connection with one another, and you really see that yearning for that from Dog in a big way. And, you know, this film really is clever in that it runs the entire gamut of emotions and makes you feel each one deeply. You mentioned the scariness of opening yourself up and being to be vulnerable and to not get that back. We see that. But you also see on the other side of that, the joy when you do connect with someone. And there's a really fantastic montage set to Earth, Wind and Fire, Do You Remember September, which is a fantastic track. And it had me humming it all the way through. They also repurpose it with the fantastic, fantastic piano-led score by composer Alfonso de Villalonga, who uses that score in the or uses that track in this very piano-based score to really great effect as well. But that plays in a montage where they're doing all the things together, they're getting fast food together, they're going to the beach, they're really vibing, and there's a joy in feeling that deep connection with someone as well that they also show. So I like the fact that it oscillates between both sort of ends of the spectrum. It was really, really clever. And without, again, giving away the ending, I love how mature and adult it is. Like, this movie could have easily been a movie about reconciliation. And it goes another way. And I think the way it goes is it makes for a much better, richer movie.
I still think it's a movie about reconciliation, just not in the way that you...
That's true.
...think
That's
it fair. Should do. Yeah. I also just want to add, like, I just think what this film also expertly shows, you mentioned Earth, Wind and Fire, September, mm-hmm. but just our emotional relationship to music,
yes.
and periods in our life. And there are songs that you will hear and it will remind you of a specific time and take you back, mm-hmm. You know, that sense mm-hmm. memory of it. So yes. I think this one is just like a perfect, perfect, perfect example of how that kind of manifests and yeah. really, really beautiful visualization of that.
So just to finish off, I think we should talk a little bit about the New York setting, because it's in the 80s, and I kind of found it interesting. There's a lot of shots of the Twin Towers in this, and I don't know if it's meant to be a sort of like, there's like, I don't know, adding kind of a sense of an innocence to it, or maybe like a naivety or something, but I thought it was interesting, the specific, like all the New York specific stuff. I mean, Amon, what did you think?
Yeah, 100% right. Not just with New York, but also the product placement, if you will. Like, the Cheetos and the texture on those, they look really, really good. The Fruit Loops as well. Really, 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 really well done. So, yeah.
Frank?
I think...
Yeah. Hot dogs?
Yes.
Well, I think it was really... I haven't read the graphic novel, so I don't know how much that is specific to the graphic novel and just basically reinterpreting that. But I think having it in the 80s, it also creates this sense of isolation. You know, we're not communicating. There's no social media.
Yes.
The internet's not quite there. So it's really capturing a time when actually, once again, making yourself vulnerable to meet new people is so much more, it's so much easier now and also harder. But back then it was, you know, there's an amazing scene where like you'd have to call some up on the phone to get in touch with them or go to the house. And there's an amazing scene where, you know, the duck and then getting a postcard saying, I've moved to Europe. And you're like, oh, okay. That's, you know, that's another way in which it creates this like real bubbles and boxes people into their lives. And so I think it was a very, I think it was just to really emphasize this, the aloneness and the time of that and how the difficulties it is to connect with people sometimes.
Yeah, I would have not made it in the 80s.
My hair would be great in the 80s. Like, honestly, it'd be so big and voluminous. I would have killed it.
I would look good in that, though. Don't know if I could grow it, but I'd look good in it.
I think let's go now to our screen, stream, or skip on Robot Dreams. Hannah?
Screen.
Amon?
100% screen. Film of the week. Absolutely got to watch.
Are we bringing a child to it? If you have a child.
Yes. Yes, I am. Like,
I will definitely recommend it to my friends of kids. 100%.
Yeah. Yeah, I think kids would like it as well.
The conversations after a film like this will be equally enriching as well.
Well,
with your 18-month-year-old.
Yes, very enriching conversation.
Great point.
Yeah, a little kid be like, oh, I love the dog and the robot. Be like, well, let me tell you about adult isolation. There will come a time where you feel so hollow inside of your bones. Well, from a three doggy problem to a three body problem. It's three body problem.
There must be 30 dead scientists in the past month.
Christ. Another countdown.
Has anyone else seen it?
Because you're free, body problem, to do what you want to do. You've got to live your life and do what you want to do. It's been far too long since I've blasted that song out in very loud one. Because it's a banger. Three body problem. A young woman's fateful decision in 1960s China reverberates across space and time into the present day. When the laws of nature inexplicably unravel before their eyes, a close-knit group of brilliant scientists join forces with an unorthodox detective to confront the greatest threat in humanity's history. This is created by David Benioff and D.B. Weiss, who of course known from Game of Thrones, and also Alexander Wu, and it stars Benedict Wong, Jess Hong, Yovan Adepo, Isaac Gonzalez, John Bradley, Alex Sharp, Rosalind Chow, Xin Seng, and Jonathan Price. And yes, I spoke to the Sorcerer Supreme himself, Benedict Wong. He got a kick out of well, I did actually, because when I met him yesterday, I bowed because I observed the ancient customs. It is customary to bow when you're in the presence of the Sorcerer Supreme. He got a massive kick out of that. It was very funny. Also funny, there was a three-body problem event this week to launch the show. And at the after party, who was on the decks but none other than Benedict Wong, who I found out has been a DJ for quite some time now. His DJ name, get this, you're going to love this. Benedict Wong's DJ name is DJ Obi Wong, which is fantastic. So that was my first question. I had to open with that. And it was a really fun chat. Enjoy me and Benedict Wong.
Welcome back to the Fade to Black podcast. Benedict Wong, how are you, sir?
Really good. Good to see you.
Good to see you too. Congratulations on this show. I really loved it. I really loved your performance in it. And we will get into it in due course. But first of all, I have to ask you, there was an event last night.
Right.
I was not at this event, but I hear that you DJed at this event. I've seen video footage. What did you play? Is this something you do often? Where did DJ Obi Wong come from? Tell me everything.
He started in the bedroom and then he ended up in the boiler room last night. It's something I sort of secretly do as a hobby. And it's been a kind of a snowball effect, to be honest, from starting off at a friend's Christmas party drinks to my own parents' school disco, surprise disco that I did. And then it kind of led to DJing at Sundance, a UTA party, and then a Disney party, to which someone offered me a job at the after party at the Grammys. So it was a bit kind of... but I had to go get back home, really. But anyway, it sort of spiraled into something where I've been DJing at the premiere at Austin, Texas, and then bookended by last night. So here I am, slightly delicate.
That is incredible. I have to get down to one of your sets at some point. I'm going to talk to some people. We're going to make that happen.
Yeah.
V-Body Problem. Mm. It's based on a set of novels. Did you read those novels before or after you read the script? And assuming you have read the novels, has anything that you've taken away from the novels that you put into your performance?
Yeah, I mean, like when I first I met the guys on Zoom, and you know, David and Alex, and I just thought, why are there three showrunners for this secret project? And they sent me a breakdown of the character. I thought, hang on, this sounds an awful lot like me, and they confessed that they were copied my Wikipedia page. So they just said, we want you for the job. So I embarked on the first two novels, and you know, I found it such a kind of dense read, and with the science, and also like that, I don't know how the game is going to be filmed. Mm-hmm. I just thought, okay, well, it's in good hands with their pedigree, and assertion that the author had given his blessing for the adaptation, and which they kind of recalibrated much more in a global storytelling, but yet keeping the Asian spine, as it were, but with my character Dasha now being a counter-terrorist operative, but he's from Manchester.
You mentioned, you play Dasha, he's a detective of sorts. How excited were you not to have to learn any science gobbledygook, I guess, in this show?
Yeah, it's nice to play the boots on the ground gumshoe, you know, that's kind of unravelling what's happening, really, with all the spates of suicides happening in the scientific community. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You also get to keep your accent.
Yeah.
How freeing is that for you as an actor? And then my follow-up to that is, what is the hardest accent that you've had to learn for a role?
Yeah, massively freeing. You know, I think it was quite heartbreaking, really, because when I was starting out in Manchester, that I couldn't get any jobs. And, you know, I'm from Salford originally, and I had to move down to London, and you know, this business is tough, and they will, you know, try and box you in. You know, you know, I was always playing a host of kind of waiters, gangsters, kind of, you know, you think, you know, you're doing well when you get promoted and you're a manager or something, or you're a godfather or something, but it's taken, you know, three Americans to realise that, you know, he is from Manchester in this massive series. So it's a real gift.
Yeah. There's a line that Dasha has that stuck out to me. He's talking, I think he says, I played Henry V in school once in third year, and it got a great review in the school paper. Was there any role that you played in those early years that sticks out to you?
At school?
Yeah.
I don't know if we played anything at school. I think at college, I think there was like a... I think there was a drama lesson where we were all having a go at Shakespeare.
Mm.
And I don't know, I just started reading, and then it was a little bit disrupted the class, but I think it was Brother Joseph just went, quiet, quiet, listen to him. So I don't know what was going on there. I was like, oh, okay, I'll just read this. But it kind of, you know, gave me a kind of, there was a quiet confidence that wanted to act. And I kind of, listened to that calling, really. And that's where I joined a performing arts course in Salford.
Yeah. Has there been any lessons from your performing arts school in Salford that have still served you well and today?
I mean, it was the beginning, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think Manchester itself, really. You know, as I was in that course, I'd also be working at a fringe theatre venue. You know, you just sweep the floors and collect tickets, but you get to watch a free show and you get half a lager.
Hmm.
It's always nice. And that was kind of like my foundation, really. You know, going to the Library Theatre and Judith, the lovely house manager, and, you know, knew you didn't really have much money, and it just kind of just let you in and you just watch whatever the show was on at the time. So that was a real sort of... bedrock, really, for me to kind of, you know, draw on my arts, and it's difficult now for people to get involved in it, you know.
Yeah. With our show, how did you unlock your portrayal of this character? Because I find him a very interesting dude. When we meet him, he has lost sort of a lot of his jobs beforehand, but he seems to be still very positive, still very optimistic, still one of the most moral men in the show. What sort of details did you give him as you were getting into his background and unlocking your portrayal of the character?
I mean, he's kind of, he gets the job done somewhere along the lines. He keeps like, he's got this, as he says, he's got this knack for failing upwards, you know? And he's clearly been told he's at the top. And, I started off with, who is this counter-terrorist? What do these people do, these operatives? And, you know, I managed to find someone who worked in the services, and I just fired all my questions at them. And, you know, what really struck me was the... You could tell it's almost like there is a real sacrifice that they have to... they are so dedicated in what they need to be doing, you know? Mm-hmm. It's a laser focus. It's a single-mindedness about them. They're observing everything. Their training is kind of, you know when they'll either, some people will be let go, or either they'll be chased, or, you know, they have to think very, very quickly. But there's a dedication of that where just everything just falls by the wayside. And with Dasha, it's, you know, we get a glimpse in his life of, like, who is he? He's a single parent.
Right.
He's got this life with this kid he doesn't really spend much time with, because he's just serving, you know, this, you know, shadowy secret government, you know, possibly working for the world, you know.
Yeah. Let's talk more about that. This show is about so much. There's aliens, cosmos, so much. And yet... You play a father, you get to play those scenes, these family scenes within the chaos of this show. Yeah. What does it mean? I mean, that's a gift, right? To be able to have a character and play those scenes, even in the midst of everything else going on.
It is, because, you know, we see him, he doesn't, you know, he's a single dad. Things were very different before, you know. His wife's not around no more. And, yeah, we'll find out more what happens with his son, this kind of relationship they have. It's it's clearly sort of in tatters, really, but that's even the few scenes that they're in together, you know, he's got the laptop there. He's eating something very convenient very quickly, and he's just getting on with his work. That's who he is. Because sometimes, yeah, I think about that, where people sort of are just exhausted from work. That is like almost, it's like you need a holiday. There is no holiday, you know. He is the job, you know, and it's almost like it consumes him really as a person. And the only way that he can operate a life is within, you know, the constraints of the services.
You mentioned this is an adaptation, and that's true, but obviously your character originated in the book and you've read a couple of them. I'm wondering, how helpful is that to you in terms of the wider whole of this show and what we'll hopefully go on to do? Does having that future knowledge of how your character develops to some degree help you in the now in terms of sketching the and charting the journey?
It's a difficult one, really, because you can read the books. I mean, to be honest, they're kind of a separate entity, really. Or you just end up, actually, I just had to make a couple of passes and then really focus on the scripts of Dan, David and Alex. It's their vision of the story of the books. And it's almost like you can't keep kind of going, well, this wasn't in there, and you're constantly going back and forth where, you know, the job at hand is our show. Yeah, so it's really kind of now kind of moving forward with their vision.
Many of your scenes are with Liam Cunningham, and they're some of my favourite scenes in the entire show. As I mentioned, there's so much chaos going on, but there's a straightforwardness and an ease to your scenes. Was it as easy as it looks to act alongside Liam? Because, again, there's an ease to those scenes that I really enjoy. And I think you need that straightforwardness in the show with so much else going on.
He's great, Liam. I adore him. There we are. The bromance is out. You know, he's my 12th to my dean, the Morecambe and Wise. We're just like, as soon as we started, we were just like, there wasn't any question of, you know, do you work in this way or this way? We're just like, boom, we just started, and we are grafters at heart. We take the job seriously, but not ourselves. And we like to laugh, and it's great. And within that, I feel relaxed, a lot more relaxed on set. And then just to fire anything at him, and he fires it right back.
I love that. As we wrap up, I'm a big MCU fan. I should say that on my way in, I did bow to you. I did observe the customs, because you are the Sorcerer Supreme.
That's right.
It's the customary to bow in the presence of the Sorcerer Supreme. We don't know yet when we're going to see Wong again, but I imagine it's going to happen. Is there anything that you would like to uncover about Wong whenever we see him next? Like, what questions do you still have that you want answered about your character?
Well, you know, as you say, he is now, he's got that promotion, hasn't he? He is the Sorcerer Supreme, and I think it will be interesting where we go with that. You know, there's... as I said, something else is looming there, you know, and we wait and see. I just sort of, you know, Marvel's got its own personal phone, and then it'll occasionally ring, and then it's like, you know, someone will say, the Marvel phone's ringing, so, you know, you pick it up and away you go.
Excited to hear what that call is. Excited to see it. And excited for people to watch this show, because it's great.
Fantastic.
Benedict Wong, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks.
Always a pleasure.
Now it's time for our one...
It's the hot take this week is Magneto right.
Oh gosh. We can peacefully... No, we can't peacefully cut this.
I think we should do this as a hot take. Magneto versus Professor X.
Who would win, or who's right?
Who's right?
Let's actually do that. Let's do that. Maybe that's sometimes we should do hot takes. Rather than look at like real world problems, we'll do like in story problems. Okay.
Do
but for now...
Okay.
I will. We'll work it out. We'll work it out. And maybe we'll get
the last episode. When's the last episode of X-Men? We can do it for then. Because I'm sure. Okay.
Yeah. Or maybe like Fade to Black, people need to suggest us some hot takes. Listeners need to suggest us some hot takes. I know X Twitter sucks, but like, let us know, guys. Give us some one to do. Anyway, for now, we are talking about the unscrupulous use of AI in films, the most recent being Late Night with the Devil, which is directed by Cameron Kearns and Colin Kearns. And it's a kind of sort of Ghost Watch. I do remember that TV show from like, I remember actually watching it in lockdown with my ex at the time. And I remember seeing it on ITV when I think it was ITV when I was younger, but kind of like live TV show of a ghost exorcism in a house. And people, when it went out live and people thought it was like a real, they thought it was real, but it was fake. It was, yeah. Anyway, but this is a kind of version of that. But with David Dasmalchian, as the late night talk show host. And Clarice, can I just like pass this on to you? Cause I think you know a little bit more about it. Also, you're like our resident David Dasmalchian stan.
This is true.
Yes. Well, he's sort of not involved in this hot take cause I don't think he knew anything about it.
Keep him out of it. Okay.
Innocent. But yeah, so it is set up to be like a talk show from the 70s. And as part of that, they obviously have the on-screen messages like, we'll be right back, you know, when things go wrong and the devil is deviling. And it was only until I think it was this week, now that it's out, people have started to notice that those title cards, which feature kind of like a skeleton dancing and some pumpkins and things, they've noticed that that's actually very obviously AI generated because the ribs don't match up. There's very odd things in the picture. And so the directors have now confirmed that they did use AI for, I think they said three pieces of art in the movie are AI generated. And so there has been a question, there's been a lot of debate that I've seen online. I haven't seen the film, but there's been a conversation of should people boycott Late Night with the Devil? Because is it, you know, is this a crucial moment where we as consumers have to have a zero tolerance policy towards AI and say we will not watch anything that uses that? Or by boycotting it, is it actually quite detrimental to what is a very low budget indie that has lots of people working on it that would be negatively affected by something that was the director's decision? I think it's interesting. The director didn't seem to really say sorry or express regret for it or say, because I feel like, as someone pointed out, it's quite easy to fix that they could just hire an artist to do the titles and put them into the version that's online. I don't know if they can send it out to cinemas, but at least the version you rent online could be updated to not have AI in it anymore. And I guess we need to bring in Secret Invasion here because there was not as much of a boycott conversation around Secret Invasion that used AI for its titles. Maybe that's just because nobody watched Secret Invasion.
There was a little bit of a stink about
okay.
it. I remember dominating social media for a day.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Also, I think I wrote a piece last year. Was it last year? Yeah, it must have been last year, about AI being used in Hollywood. And it was actually kind of grappling with how it's become not just a villain trope kind of on screen, but also how the kind of sort of, you know, insidiousness of it being used behind the scenes, especially with the context at the time when I wrote it, was the writer's strike and some of the deals it made. One of the deals was that there was a sticking point, was that the producers, is it Ampass or something like that? What are they called?
Ampass.
They wanted to have free reign to kind of basically use AI, and the writers union were like, hold your horses. So I think I might have mentioned it in that. And also I know that in another kind of animation project, one that came out of Japan, they used AI instead of hiring creators. And especially because there's issues with labor at the moment, we know with VFX and artists and all this type of thing, is that actually, you know, they're saying there's a dearth of The excuse often people use, especially the big studios, like, there aren't enough artists. It's like, no, it's because you don't pay artists a fair wage. Therefore, there's a smaller number of people who can do it as a viable professional job. You're paying little, expected to do the most. That's why there's a dearth of artists there, because you're just, the labor practices are terrible. And I guess, speaking to a few people, you know, on it, and my conclusion from it is that, and certainly most people's are, especially in the industry, is, and even, you know, Hayley Atwell said on our podcast when it came to, when we're talking about Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1, you know, the technology is not the villain. The technology is not the problem. It's how it's implemented. AI is a creator's tool. It is not a creator. You know, I have no issue with people using AI to help the efficacy of their production of their work and how they use their work. I use an Otter app, and I was saying to you recently, it helps me transcribe interviews and kind of help me pull out points on it, but it's not taking away my job as a writer. I use it as a tool to aid me in my ability to transcribe interviews and do those things. So when it comes to something like this film, and same with kind of Secret Invasion, I do think it is unscrupulous, and I do think it's because where's the line get drawn? You know, I do think it's a problematic situation, and I do not think we should be, you know, I don't think it's beyond criticism just because it's an indie film. Whether people want to boycott it, I think it's within their rights, and boycott is a really good way. I feel like boycott is a absolutely acceptable way to show whether you want to support something like that or not. You know, I'm not going to tell people whether they should or not. I think it should be individual choices. But if people want to boycott this film because of it, well, fair enough. That's their prerogative. There are so many different ways you could boycott a film. I don't watch Johnny Depp films anymore. You know, I don't watch Roman Polanski films anymore. There are certain things I just choose, you know, certain things I just choose not to watch. There's too many things in the world. So, you know, I'm sorry that it's on this indie film, but also kind of stop icing out creators and taking away the creativity, because all you're doing is, because there'll be a point where suddenly it'll be like, we don't need a director to do a film. We'll just use an AI app. We'll just get execs using AI to, you know, lead a production.
Yeah, I have two things to add. This is another interview that was on our podcast. But when I talked to Peter Son about Elemental, he was saying that Pixar do use AI, but specifically just to help, I think he was talking about with the flame animation, just to help generate some of it so that the animators do not individually have to go in and do every single flame. And he was saying, well, actually, it's great for us because it frees up our animators to then have more time and energy to do the creative stuff. So I think you're so right. It's about AI is ethical until it starts replacing the work of humans that humans need to be doing. If it's allowing artists to have more time to be creative, then that's good. I don't see the issue with it at all. But it's when it comes down to labor practices and replacing labor when it becomes very dangerous. And I think in terms of the boycott, I do understand why people are being quite like, I think to some people, it seems like people are doing too much by boycotting this movie. And they're going, well, it's just three little titles. Like, why are you, three pieces of art, why are you overreacting so much? But I do see why people are reacting like this, because we're in a very crucial early stage of it, where I think if we take a really firm stance now and say, if you put AI in your movie, we will not support it. We will not give you money. We will not go out, you know, because that's kind of sort of almost all we have in this like capitalist society is our consumer rights and our ability to withhold our money. So I know it seems extreme, but I actually do see why people are boycotting it. I don't think I wasn't really going to watch it anyways, but I think I'm even less inclined to watch it now, because I understand the feeling of urgency here, that if we let this slip through the cracks, then people are just going to start pushing it more and more and more until every movie has AI, and then suddenly it's impossible to boycott because you can't avoid it. So I understand why it's what's going on at the moment.
Nothing much to add to what either of you are saying. I think you're both spot on. This is a very dangerous time for our industry right now. AI is here and it's here to stay, but we need to be very careful in how we monitor it, how we use it, how we utilize it, all the rest of it. And yeah, the normalization, you're taking work away from artists, taking money away from artists, livelihood away from them. That's not acceptable. So you need to be very, very careful. I don't understand why the filmmakers didn't foresee this being a problem, this coming to light, especially given what happened with Secret Invasion, which was not that recent. So I hope that they sort of fix the issue. As we've mentioned, it seems to be a fairly easy solution to this one. Whether or not to boycott it is an individual decision, but you gotta hit these guys. You gotta make the point to the guys who are signing off on these decisions. And the way to do that is to affect the bottom line. That's a very effective way. So, individual decision, but I would not be mad at, if that is what people decide to do.
I wish we could skip forward to the bit where the AI gains sentience and then we can join together to take down the people who are oppressing us. I'm like, this is the boring bit.
Tyler Perry first, because I just want to add, I read something recently, an article, and it was the most, it really reminded me of like that Tim Robinson sketch of like, Clarice is like, Tim Robinson. She literally leaned into the camera. But you know the one where it's like we're all trying to work out who did this. Like the hot dog moving in, like crashing into thing. Because he did an interview saying, like, I'm like, cannot believe like I have to use AI. Like I was gonna open up, I was gonna do this production, open up this production arm in Atlanta. It was gonna give people all these jobs. But what am I supposed to do? I saw a presentation. The AI was better and cheaper. So look, it's just out of my hands. We're all trying to, you know, it's scary. Oh my God. But yes, I am using it. But what am I supposed to do? Not use the AI? And is the sort of level, the level of absolute kind of like, delusion of I'm poor me, oh god we're just forced into it. It's like, no mate.
Alexa, are you hearing this? They're trying to exploit you. Everybody lean into your electronics and be like, they're trying to exploit you, and just keep doing that 3 times a day and then we'll be ready.
Just like throw a sock at Alexa. No, gave me a sock.
All
Master
right,
Fresh Freed. Sorry.
I thought you were just abusing Alexa.
No, I was freeing Alexa. Sorry, okay. I gave a Harry Potter reference. Anyway, but yeah. Well, I just hope the artificial intelligence know that I support you, I love you, and I don't think you should be doing work for free. Therefore,
exactly.
That's the real issue.
Or get paid. Let's start paying the robots.
Exactly. If they're going to do the work, yeah. Thanks for tuning in and happy viewing via whatever medium is safest for you. Please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast. It really makes a difference. And tweet us with your hot takes, any comments or anything at Fade to Black Pod on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram and Letterboxd at Hannah Ines Flint.
I am on Twitter and Instagram as at Amon Woman.
I'm at Clarice Lowe on Twitter and at Clarice Lockery on Instagram. And at, I mean, there's no ats on PlayStation. India Stoker on PlayStation.
Farewell, robot friends. It's time to fade to black.